Okay. So you have a new book, Eco-Civilization, as I just said.
Right.
What do you want to explain what eco-civilization is?
Sure. Well, really, what it is the it's a vision of a practical opportunity that is available to us for humanity to actually look at kind of reorganizing the very basis of our entire world system. Like it's a kind of a recognition that the way our whole world system is based right now is on principles, things like exploitation and extraction and separation between people and from the rest of life. And that's not what most of us as human beings actually want from the world. And so what the book does is it's kind of explores what the world could look like if we're actually simply organized around setting the conditions for all beings to thrive on a regenerated earth.
That's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, and the thing is, when you think about it, the vast majority of people, I mean, probably if you asked, any random person in the world, my guess is well over 95% would say, well, of course the world should be based on a system like that. That's so obvious. But that is almost the opposite of how our world actually is based. And I think that's the sort of crucial thing to understand is how fundamentally radically different things could be if it were simply organized the way most people would like it to be organized.
And part of your motivation in putting your mind to work on this on this big question is a recognition that the system that we're in is falling apart.
Yes, I think that's absolutely crucial for people to realize. Like many, many people around the world, with best intentions and really caring about things, are basically trying to do things to fix the system. They look at what's going wrong, so many things, and they go, "Well, things are broken. Like, if we can fix this, if we can shift towards renewables, or if we can like reduce inequality somewhat with higher taxes or something, things can work better." But what I feel people they're missing is that actually the system isn't broken at all. The system is doing exactly what it was intended to do. It's a system that developed really starting, you could go different layers, but in its modern version, really began sort of with the rise of the dominance of Europe back in the 17th century and the scientific revolution. And it's a system really that is really like the economic manifestation of the worldview that arose then, which saw it was a worldview of separation, seeing the rest of life as machines and seeing other humans to things to exploit. And so that's it's a system basically of extraction and exploitation that has become so pervasive that now people feel it's the only sort of system that is available in the world. And you can give it a name and call it global capitalism, but fundamentally, it's about looking at other people as resources to exploit and the rest of life as resources to extract from.
And you see, because of climate limitations, because of the depth of this inequality and what that does, how that raises the chances of people responding with violence.
Yes. I mean, I think that honestly, most people nowadays, I think, are beginning to feel in their gut exactly this thing that the system is not just that the system's broken, but it's designed to basically screw them, to make their lives not work. And without a clear diagnosis of the reasons why, they quite appropriately get angry. And then the question is, what should be the source of their anger? Now, my interpretation is that the source of the anger should be this system that sucks all the wealth to this tiny group of elites. But the very people who are benefiting from the system obviously don't want themselves to be the target of everybody's anger. So they deflect the anger to these made up things, like whether it's undocumented immigrants in a country, or people who are immigrants in a country but don't look the same as the majority of the people in the country, or they might target all these liberals, like in my country, the US. You know, there's this target of all these people who have made our lives intolerable because they've been trying to essentially make the world a more equal place. And so they kind of very skillfully redirect people's anger towards other targets that keep them safe. And so a lot of this anger and violence that we see right now is, in a sense, the original source of that is kind of justifiable. It's this recognition of alienation from a system that is designed to basically exploit them, but is then turned into these very violent and dangerous and sometimes tragic outcomes.
Yeah, I find it so I don't even know what the word is. Ironic doesn't cover it. But the sense of being left out, the sense of being abused, it's continually directed to whoever's in power now. And then that group leaves, and then the next group comes in, and then the anger is directed at them. And it's the anger is justifiable, as you were saying, but the capacity to see it in a bigger frame, that it's this it's the in, entire this is the way the world has been set up to work, is not what people are seeing, what many people seem to be capable of realizing.
Well, I think that's right, but I think also it's partly because the press and the media and all the different influences who create our basically our popular culture are really, and in many cases, part of that very system. And their whole approach is designed to not have people look at the true diagnosis of the system. There was a basically a Marxist philosopher and historian in Italy called Antonin Gramsci back in the
Gramsci, yeah.
1930s, right, exactly, who basically he described it perfectly as this notion of what he calls cultural hegemony, that there's this whole group of people like the media, or and there could be lawyers or influencers or thought leaders, whose primary task, their primary role, is to be the sort of advance guard, if you will, for the elites, who then they get to stay safe in their sort of atop everything else by basically telling people this is the way the system works and this is how you should be optimizing what you do in the system, all for the benefit of the elites rather than for people as a whole. So it's very difficult for people to actually understand what the true causes are. You have to do a lot of work and research to really understand that. And then to make, I think a big significant thing around that is you're talking about getting angry at those who get voted into power and then voting the other people into power. And there's this sense that most of us have in the West that we live in democracies and that ultimately people get to choose their leaders. And if a leader's a bad, well, maybe that's our fault for choosing the wrong ones, or there's no real sense that somehow the system itself is designed like that. But the reality is that what we call electoral democracy, even in countries where it works reasonably well, which is very different from the US, of course, where I'm calling from right now, but it's really not electoral democracy. It's really like electoral oligarchy. It's essentially like oligarchy by consent, where in general people get to choose between two or three, sometimes different groups of oligarchs, essentially people who are very wealthy, were either born into or got to find themselves in this very elite groups. And the groups might be slightly different, but they're all about like should one power block be like even more helping corporations and businesses, or should one power block be helping them, but with a little bit more of a humane kind of element? But any radical alternatives simply don't get put into the picture.
So now I have a question. that I'm very curious about. So we have this stew right now, this bubbling brew of fail system failure and blame and fear and violence and all this bubbling mess. And you have put yourself behind this view, this eco-civilization view. You see it as possible. So you're trusting in something. What are you trusting in?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And what I am trusting in, and what I feel that is available for all of us to trust in, is ultimately a sense of the intrinsic evolved capacity of humans, of human nature, to actually want things like justice, fairness, care for each other, care for community, care for the living earth all around us. And fundamentally, that's the trust. When we look at the sort of power imbalances between that relatively small group of people like me who are looking at what's possible and putting their lives into trying to make that happen, the power imbalance between that group and the groups from that cultural hegemony, who've got all the money, the political power, the military power, the power of the media, all that stuff, it would seem almost hopeless. But what I believe we, those who want that life-affirming, beneficial future, have on our side is basically the hearts and minds of the vast bulk of human beings. Every single human being born into this earth brings with them an evolved disposition towards caring, towards love, towards wanting a sense of security for themselves and those loved ones around them, wanting to be part of something bigger, wanting to be connected with all of life. That's our evolved predisposition. So this dominant system has to basically then spend years conditioning people out of that and telling them, no, you should be individualistic and selfish and consumerist and all this stuff. But it takes years and years of conditioning to get people to forget what they truly are. And that's what I ultimately have trust in, is the potential. And we can talk about the likelihood or whatever of all this happening, but that there is this potential, if enough human beings get to reconnect with what is truly meaningful for us, that this entire system can be turned around.
So taking it one step further, you trust that there are opportunities for this to, you said if enough people have an experience of this nature and context in which it's allowed to be expressed, that then something can that then something could take over.
Yes, I think the trust is in the intrinsic pro-social characteristics of human beings. We evolved as sort of Homo sapiens and even the earlier hominids before Homo sapiens. We evolved to basically find our survival and our thriving in groups, in communities. That was like millions of years ago. Our hominid ancestors found themselves in dangerous places in the savannah rather than sort of hiding behind trees or whatever. And those groups that actually worked together collaboratively were the ones who ended up surviving and thriving. And over literally millions of years, our pre-hominid ancestors evolved what are nowadays known as social emotions. So we feel things like embarrassment or guilt if we do something wrong, and we intrinsically feel positive towards somebody we see as being generous. And we have this evolved sense of fairness that most people in the world will even put themselves at risk if they see an injustice being done and want to put it right. These are things that we, it's not, there's this old view of human nature that was popularized by Richard Dawkins when he wrote the book Selfish Gene. And
Mm-hmm.
it's basically is the almost like the dominant view of human nature now, which is that humans are basically selfish, individualistic, and that's how we evolved. But what we need to do, in Richard Dawkins's terms, is overcome our evolved nature and use our reason to somehow conquer our those negative selfish drives and become better people. I don't see it like that at all. In fact, I see it as the opposite. There are evolved human drives, and this is not my unique interpretation. This is many, many, many leading evolutionary biologists and psychologists, evolutionary psychologists over many, many decades now have shown this to be true. That basically our drives are those pro-social emotions. And that's why in early hunter-gatherer communities, when you'd have somebody, some sort of atavistic male who was more like our sort of primate ancestors and wanted to get, was too big for his britches and wanted to like take over everything. Nobody liked that. Everybody saw that as dangerous and wrong. And oftentimes the group would come together and ostracize that person if they continued to act in that way. And that's how those groups maintained those group dynamics and survived and thrived and evolved over millions of years to become Homo sapiens. And so that's the core element of humanity that I have real trust in. And our system basically is designed to minimize the power of those kind of evolved traits and to incent those far less pro-social traits, the antisocial traits. And that's what we have to like, th that's what we're stuck in right now.
So how do you see the tide turning here?
Well, I think one of the most important ways for that tide to turn is for people to begin to believe that there actually is that possible future. Because for decades now, there has been a sense, really with the rise of neoliberalism, the last 30 or 40 years, there's been an increasing sense that, like, well, in the words of Margaret Thatcher, there is no alternative. This is a famous phrase she used called TINA. And m almost everyone now believes that. So it's felt, we feel like there's only global capitalism. We do what we can. And even, you know, for most people, they might think, well, this is the way the system is, too difficult to change it. So I may as well look after myself and try to be as successful as I can within that system. And those who are wanting to make it better, even they are saying, well, we have to work within the system. There's not much we can do to change it. So I feel one of the ways for that tide to turn is to recognize there is another system available to us. And we're not talking about some utopia that will never really happen, but we're talking about a system that actually is designed around our evolved human instincts. And there are many examples around the world of groups, and either very small community groups or larger groups or regions that have done a great job of showing alternatives that are possible rather than this kind of extraction exploitation approach that is dominant right now.
Can you give an example?
Well, there's a number of different examples. One simple one, for example, to begin with, is we think that the only ways that corporations can work is when they are these hierarchical, shareholder-driven corporations. That's basically corporations right now are the most powerful force in the world. Like, if you look at the largest 100 economies, about 70 out of those 100 are actually corporations rather than countries. And then you've got an example like Mondragon in the Basque Country in Spain, which is this hugely successful, large industrial conglomerate that is a cooperative, where basically everyone who works there shares the ownership of all these different companies. And even the highest paid executive only gets paid about three times the level of of an average worker in those companies. So there's great amount of egalitarian quality, and power is distributed like that too. And there's a sense of caring for people in the way the organization works. That's one example of how there's a different way of organizing. But there are many others too. There are regions where we've actually there's true grassroots democracy, such as in Rojava in Syria, which is actually under attack from the Syrian government right now. And so we don't even know how long lived it'll be, but it's a region of millions of people, which is organized around what's known as democratic confederalism, where basically democracy is truly grassroots, where every single block in a city or a town have their own assemblies where they make their own decisions. And then that is fractally, they're voted to have representatives of the next level up for the neighborhood, the next level up for the city, next level up for the region, all the way up to the entire 4 million people, kind of quasi sort of state. And in all cases, rather than a top-down form of governance, it's really governance by the people for the entire community. And it's worked very successfully. And in spite of all the war there, Rojava has become really the most prosperous region in that whole area, and has basically totally subverted the patriarchy that is so prevalent in that area, because women and men are given equal power all the way through the system.
Kurds also, yeah.
And well, that is the Kurds group,
Oh,
but
I
the
didn't
thing to
recognize it.
understand is, well, the Kurds are the largest ethnic group in that area. They're not even the majority there. It's a multi-ethnic community, but there are more
Interesting.
Kurds than other minorities there. But and that's part of it too, that it's multi-ethnic,
Yeah.
inclusive of different faiths and different groups.
Well, that in that area, that's stunning, isn't it?
It is.
Do you have a sense from the people, from information that's coming out from that region, what people's sense of motivation is? What would be the right word? What how do they find this compelling and different?
Very much so. In this area, there is one strong charismatic leader who was really instrumental in shifting this. His name is Abdullah Öcalan, who's actually been a captive of Turkey. He's a political prisoner in Turkey for decades, but he still has very significant influence over the people, over the Kurd people in that area. And what is interesting is he got inspired by the work of an American social philosopher called Murray Bookchin, who had written about these ideas for decades. And it was a great story, because Öcalan discovered these works of Murray Bookchin there in jail in the Turkish prison. And he got so inspired that he reached out to him and helped to form his own ideas of what's possible. And the interesting story there is that, like, Öcalan had originally been more like a traditional communist, if you will, like knowing that the capitalist regime was wrong. And for decades, the Kurd people had been fighting for Kurd independence, but wanting basically like a socialist Kurdistan based on a state-organized distribution system. So the insight that Öcalan had was that really what all you're doing is transferring one centralized authority of, say, big corporations and government to another, which is like some state-organized oppressive authority. But you're not actually really allowing power for really individual people based on their dignity. This different approach is one that actually pushes power down to the people. And that people have been thriving there, and they really have been like really transforming their own lives and their own communities based on this recognition that they can actually make their own judgments. Oftentimes, women suddenly discover that they are empowered, and they can actually choose to pursue their own life rather than be stuck doing what patriarchy tells them they need to do. So there's been a tremendous amount of empowerment there. In fact, they've been having to still fight militarily because of all the dynamics of the region. And there are many army battalions there that are purely composed of women,
Women, yeah.
actually fighting for this process.
That's wonderful. So your trust is in this ultimate, your trust is in actually the evolutionary capacity that humans have for
Well,
cooperation.
yes, exactly. The evolved capacity that we have for cooperation and our evolved instinct to want to do that. It, in fact, really, if you look from an evolutionary perspective, human beings are one of the most cooperative species that life has ever produced on Earth. There are some species, of course, like ants or termites, that are all part of almost like this kind of a collective mind. And you can almost see they almost don't have separate individual identity, but it's more like a collective intelligence. Humans are in between that. And we, of course, have our own individual free will and our own way of developing our own ways of being. But we're way far more cooperative than almost any other mammals. And it's that cooperation that has been really the secret of our success. That's the title of a book by somebody called Heinrich, which looks at our cooperative capacity as what has really led to humans basically collectively over many generations becoming far and away the most powerful species on the earth.
And I and part of what you're saying is that there are opportunities for this to be expressed at every level of culture.
This is exactly right. And beyond those examples I just gave, there's a whole set of examples around what's known as the commons, which is a really fascinating and important idea. And oftentimes when that word, the commons, is spoken about, usually just in our sort of normal culture, it seems to hark back to medieval times. And at least when I first heard the word, it was like I had this image of medieval farmers, and there's this meadow, and they're allowing their sheep to all kind of eat in the commons together. And that was science sense with this kind of ancient sort of term. And there was an economist, an American neoliberal economist called Garrett Hardin, who wrote some decades back in the 1970s. An essay called "The Tragedy of the Commons," and it became actually the most widespread read academic article ever, I think, in the whole academic population. And basically, what he came up with was this idea that the commons is intrinsically a tragedy because since people are all selfish and individualistic. If they all want their sheep to go and be as fat as possible rather than other people's, so they'll all go onto the commons. The commons will end up getting used up because everyone will only care about themselves rather than the shared property. And then we'll all be destroyed. And that's the tragedy. And so the answer is private ownership is the way to go because then people are re truly looking out for their long-term interests. And so that's going to be better. So this became well, obviously the commons, the sort of standard thinking then was that this is proof the commons was no good. But this was a completely made up illusion in his mind. And some decades later, an economist, well, actually she was more like a political theorist, but she won the Nobel Prize for Economics, whose name is Eleanor Ostrom, who actually studied the commons and actually studied groups throughout, all around the world, who had formed commons-based, self-organized ways of organizing themselves, oftentimes lasting for hundreds, if not thousands of years in different areas. And she found that the exact opposite of what Garrett Hardin said was the truth, that when people are organized around the commons, that is more like our evolved human heritage. And people actually develop principles of working together. And so if somebody begins to act in a way that isn't for the common good, then there's what she called ratcheted sanctions. At first, people say, "Hey, don't do
Stop
that. You shouldn't do that." And
it.
people mostly respond, "Oh yeah, I don't want to be disliked by my peers. I'll get back in line." And then when people still continue to act wrong, those sanctions get bigger and bigger. But the point is that that works in a stable way, and the groupers themselves develop their own roles. And when it's time to change those roles because of changing circumstances, they have their own self-organized ways of meeting and coming up with their new roles. So they make their own roles, they police their own roles together, and they adapt as necessary, and they care for the long term for their future generations and those around them. And that's been shown to be very successful. But the beauty of this is that those same principles can apply in the modern world. So we see this, or you can see that one of the most modern things we have is like Wikipedia. Well, one of the most successful dynamics over the last few decades is this. You'd think it was almost impossible. This group of self-organized people from all around the world, without getting paid, who choose to build an encyclopedia of human knowledge that is every bit and at this point probably more reputable and credible than anything like the Encyclopedia Britannica or anything that went before it. And is so extensive and so deep and self-organizing and self-policing, just like those commons are. And you see that in other technological breakthroughs like Firefox, a browser that has come. But you also see it in way things can be organized in countries. In the Netherlands, there's this healthcare community called Bertzorg, which basically is a self-organized, non-hierarchical set of people who take care of each other. They're paid, just like home healthcare workers. But rather than have some big company managing them, they manage themselves. They end up spending more time with the people they're caring for. They do it more effectively. It leads to significantly less hospitalization for the people who are getting the care, because this human heart becomes part of the driving process rather than profit-driven exploitation.
What's exciting about what you're saying, given the examples that you're giving, or one of the exciting things, is that this way of perceiving and this way of working can be brought anywhere.
This is exactly right. And let me just make a suggestion of a book. If anyone is interested in really understanding more about the commons at a deeper place, there's a book called Free, Fair, and Alive, written by David Bollier and Silke Helfrich, which really was transformative for me in doing all the research I did for this work to discover this concept of the commons. And they bring up this notion of what they call commoning as a verb, like this, that once we really reconnect with our human evolved instincts, we actually can begin to almost like shift our ontology, shift our way of being, and really begin to see our identity as part of the group that we're working with, rather than some individual who's trying to look out for themselves in that group. But actually, our identity begins to be extended to the group we're working with, which is, again, part of what our human evolved identity naturally wants to do.
Wonderful. I don't quite know how to ask this question, but it's sort of, what is your trust for in terms of time scale? Because we're in a quite a time sensitive run for the precipice. And while what you're saying could be could shift the way organizations work, the way communities work, the way land is managed, et cetera, and people could just do that. it's likely that this system is going to fail and fail big.
Yes. I think that's right. And so that leads to a different kind of trust. So everything we've been talking about is the sort of core fundamental, like trust in human nature, really, basically. And now, as we're looking at where the system is going, to me, that really calls for a different kind of trust. And really, I would call that more like trusting in the possibility. Because as I look at where we're going now, as I write in this eco-civilization book, it's very much along the lines of what you're saying. What we see is a system that is coming apart. We see all kinds of oppression, increase in violence, breakdown of even the more tentative elements of some sort of global structure and some sense of values around what goes on in the world rather than just sheer exploitation and aggression. And we see it getting worse and worse. And with the rise of AI and with further climate breakdown, rise of authoritarianism, it's hard to look at the future with any sense of optimism or sense of like, oh, we'll make this through. And I'm no believer, I don't think it's helpful to have any kind of false optimism, what sometimes people will call hopium. And so even though this book I've written and my own approach is about looking at this possibility for a really fundamentally better future, I don't go around trying to pretend that, oh yeah, it's going to happen, don't worry about it. Quite the opposite. I think that the likelihood is things are going to get worse and worse, maybe even to the point of a total collapse of our entire world system. Many people look at that and say it's inevitable that things are going to collapse. But what I look at is the fact that, and this comes a lot from my own earlier research that led to writing books like The Web of Meaning and The Patterning Instinct, the earlier books I've written, which very much are imbued in a deep sense of systems thinking and recognizing that what we live in is a highly complex system which has a lot of nonlinear dynamics about it. And we don't just live in one highly complex system. We live in a confluence of different highly complex nonlinear systems. There's the whole system of our human organization, which is impossible to predict and highly complex. There's the whole system of the living earth that we're embedded in, which also has its nonlinear components, and those interact together. So that it's impossible, I would say, intrinsically, to actually predict what is going to happen even 10 years from now, never mind 30 or 50 years from now in our future. We can see that there's likelihoods and things are not looking good, but it's the trust in that non-linear aspect of where things can go that allows me to feel a sense that it's worth putting all my energy personally and all of us who are caring about that future to collectively put our energy into trying to make something happen. Because we've seen only too many times in history where, what was once viewed as impossible suddenly becomes possible. And then once it happens, people look back and say, oh yeah, it was inevitable.
Inevitable.
Exactly. And we simply can't know. But the one thing we can know is that those of us who are in a relatively privileged place of having the luxury to look at what's going on and choose to some degree where we put our lives and effort, our attention, that we're in a place where we actually can be part of trying to make those changes happen. There's a great quote by another systems author. His name is Brian Klass, who has also written books about our society as complex systems. And it's a very pithy way in which he summarizes. He basically says, you control nothing, you influence everything. And I think that's a brilliant way of understanding it, that all the different choices we make day by day, year by year, are having an influence in whatever the future is that unfolds. None of us can make it happen in the way we want, but we're all part of co-creating something that's possible. And that's what I trust, and that's what I fundamentally trust in.
That's great, and you that quote and something you said earlier speaks to not knowing. The
Yes.
fact that we can't know,
Exactly.
but it's like, where do we anchor ourselves?
Exactly.
And do we anchor ourselves in the possibility?
That is
And
exactly right. Yeah.
also that not knowing is the foundation of almost every spiritual practice.
Completely right. I love where you're going with that. And there is that beautiful Buddhist concept of like going to this place of not knowing, and sometimes call it beginner's mind, just like looking at things from that fresh place. And I think that's absolutely right, that so much of what we do with our conceptual mindsets is we put frames around things. We sort of make meaning out of what we see around us, and we create like a lens through which we see things. And part of what we're talking about is recognizing that even though those of us who it looks so certain that it's got to go this way, that these are frames that we give ourselves. And by letting go of those, it opens us up to greater possibilities. And the one thing that we do know each day is very different from that Descartes thing that was the foundation of modern quasi-scientific thinking, cogito ergo sum. That he to him that was the bedrock. I think, therefore, I am. And in fact, that's almost like this paradigm of kind of what went wrong in a way with the last 500 years, is this notion that the thinking is the one thing you can rely on. It's almost the opposite. It's actually what you can do is let go of our minds trying to make sense of things and just feel into more like I exist, therefore I am. I sense. I'm a sensing, living, breathing entity. And that is one thing we know. And as that, we know that we are part of life, that we're not separate from life, that we are one evolved, each of us is one evolved manifestation of this incredible, miraculous force of life that's evolved over billions of years into this rich complexity. And as a part of life, we can know that we have the choice of putting that life's energy into acting for the benefit of life in terms of what we're doing. So that's the one thing we can do each day. And it's when we do that, when enough of us can do that, connect with others who are doing that, that gives that, however slim, we don't know, that possibility of the transformation towards that positive future that could be so much better for all of us.
Thank you. That was beautiful. Thank you very much. Appreciate your work, appreciate your heart,
Well, great.
and
Well,
bringing your mind in service of your heart.
thank you. Thank you, Elizabeth. And thank you for your probing and your questions, which really I felt helped to get us to those deeper layers
Yeah.
of understanding. Thank you.
Great. Great. Okay, so Mike will be in touch with you, and look forward to having you in our
Great.
magazine. And
All right. Well, thank
thank
you
you
very
for
much.
everything. Your time.
Yeah. Well, good to talk with you, Elizabeth. And thank you for what you and Mike are doing with the magazine. Sounds great.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right.
Okay. Have a good day.
You too. Take care now. Bye.
Bye-bye.